I want to turn your attention to the book of Hebrews, if you would, with me, chapter 5. In our last study, we opened a series we're calling A Tribute to the Lamb. We have entered the garden. We entered just as Judas was arriving with 600 armed soldiers, the temple police, and a mob of others who have come thinking they were going to arrest him, and yet they found themselves arrested by this I Am, Jesus Christ, the Son of God. We found the Lord ready and waiting for them. He was composed. He was submissive, helpful. He was in authority. He had great composure. How could he, although God 100%, also man 100%, be so composed and sure? Well, I think as we studied in our last discussion, the answer to that question of his composure was that his composure was a direct result of his perspective. He knew that the cup that he would drink was a cup that had come from the Father's hand. But my next question that I want to answer is, how did he get such perspective? And that's what we're going to find out. If you look at the summary of what occurred in the garden, Hebrews gives it to us, chapter 5, verse 7. It sort of says it all. In the days of his flesh, I believe referring to this point here, this story in the garden, he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death. He was heard because of his piety. Although he was God, that is, he was a son, capital S, he learned obedience, being the man, from the things which he suffered. Now, I don't believe that you and I can for a moment begin to appreciate the story of the garden unless we understand that we're about to view Jesus as a man. And you sort of have to reformat your thinking as you view him in the garden as he struggles. And it will be of great help to you because he is the model man for you and I as we struggle in our garden of Gethsemane, whatever and wherever that may be. We will watch him in this story and we will marvel. And ultimately, we will worship this Lamb. I read that before the Iran-Iraq war occurred, or was about to occur, the Iraqi soldiers went out into the desert sands and dug 40,000 graves. Not for the ones they hoped to kill, but for themselves. Those open graves were a dusty testimonial to the fact that they expected and were willing to die. What we're about to see in the garden is nothing less than Jesus Christ. It is a shocking scene, and I think we can understand it if we see him in effect digging his grave. And he is looking into the open pit, and it crushes his spirit, for he, the man, would not want to die any more than you or I would want to die. And yet that grave there in the garden will signify his willingness. His actions will signify his testimonial that he is willing to die for you and me. Now, John chapter 18 opens with just a brief mention that he had gone there with his disciples. The amplified account is found in Matthew. Would you turn there? Matthew's Gospel, chapter 26. And let's begin by hearing from Matthew what John has left out. Matthew chapter 26, and let's begin at verse 36. Then Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." Now picture in your mind something a little different from maybe your garden or a garden you grew up nearby. Jerusalem being a crowded city, people pressing on every corner, they had laws that restricted anybody from having a private garden within the city proper. And they also had an old sacred law that said since the soil of Jerusalem is sacred, they would prohibit the spreading of manure in the soil. And of course, I'm sure the people appreciated that, being rather crowded in their condition. However, some very wealthy residents owned gardens outside the city walls, especially on this mountainside called the Mount of Olives, which is predominant in the narrative of Christ's latter days. And it would be there where they would, these wealthy residents, have their acre or two, and they would build beautiful stone walls around them, and they would not really plant vegetables. They would nurture their trees, their olive trees, and perhaps flowers that would grow in that kind of condition. Evidently, Jesus had a very wealthy friend, and that wealthy friend had allowed Jesus to retreat in his own private place of rest for prayer. Verse 37. And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be grieved and distressed. He took these three, that is, into the inner recesses of this garden. Now, why did he take these three and station them there? Well, there are a number of suggestions. One would be that Jesus wanted protection for his privacy, although I really don't think that was it, because he didn't need to be protected, and he would soon show just by one breath of his power, they would all fall on their backs. Some have suggested that it was to provide companionship, but they didn't do that either. I think the third would be the one that I would throw my hat in on, and that was that he had brought them into the inner recesses, not for protection or companionship, but for instruction. He was about to show his three closest friends his agony, and before they would nod off and go to sleep, they would see enough, they would hear enough that would come back and probably haunt them, and most importantly, instruct them. See, he is going to teach them. This is how you prepare for a cross. This is how you walk through a lonely garden. This is how you handle sorrow. And he is going to teach them this. Now, there are two very important words that show us the emotion. And again, we're looking at a man, a God-man. Two key words. The first is in verse 37. It says, he began to be grieved. The King James and the NIV translate that sorrowful. It could be rendered, he began to be troubled. It implied, that word, a shrinking back from some horrifying experience. An experience that he cannot get away from. So the word is used by the ancients in that way. Don't forget here that Jesus Christ is not an actor. Jesus is not knowing that one day there are going to be a lot of people gathered on Tryon Road studying his story, and so he wants to be able to feel what they felt, and so he's in the garden and he's drumming it up. He's working up the sorrow. Oh no, don't think for a moment this is play acting. This is for real. He is surrounded by sorrow. And that is the next word, the word distressed in that same verse. The King James takes heavy as its translation. The NIV, troubled, literally means to be overwhelmed, to be crushed by distress. You could translate it, surrounded by sorrow. What a picture. Why such agony for this God-man? Verse 38 helps just by expressing it. Then he said to them, my soul is deeply grieved. You could translate that, depressed, to the point of death. Remain here and keep watch with me. Why this distress? Why this surrounding of sorrow? Could it be because of the betrayal? Judas, could that have impacted him? I would doubt it, although I'm sure you and I would be fairly offended if we were betrayed for the price of a crippled slave. Was it perhaps the denial of Peter, the man that he had invested so much time and energy and patience in, and now Peter will curse that he never knew him? Maybe that. Could it have been the nation Israel rejecting him? He, the one who would come to save them, would hear them cry, we have no king but Caesar. Crucify him. Perhaps. Could it have been the injustice of it all? He, the creator of justice, now unjustly treated, maybe. Maybe it was the coming loss of fellowship and intimacy with the Father. He will cry, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? The word is, why have you abandoned me? Was it because he would become sin for us and he had never known the stain of sin? I think it's all of them, all wrapped up in a million times more. That's why he was crushed with despair. There's another picture in Mark chapter 14, the passage reads, he said to them, "My soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch." And then the text says, "And he went a little while and he fell to the ground and began to pray." Now we have an oil painting, at least I've seen one. You may have it. It's of Jesus in the garden praying, and his hands are clasped, and he's kneeling at a stone, and he's looking up into the heavens fairly serenely in prayer. Now, if you have it, don't throw it away. I'm sure he had that posture at some point when he prayed, but not here. It's in what's called the imperfect tense. That means it is action in progress. Do you know what Mark is saying? Mark is saying that Jesus went into the inner recesses and he fell. And then he prayed. And then he picked himself back up again. And he staggered a few more steps. And then he fell again and he prayed. Then he picked himself up and he staggered around a little bit more. And then he fell again and he prayed. And Hebrews says that he prayed with loud tears. Can you imagine that? The Son of God staggering about and falling and praying and picking himself back up and then falling and praying again. Imagine that. Falling, crying, staggering, falling, crying. The Lamb about to be killed. Luke also gives us another picture in this garden that we missed in John. In chapter 22, let me just read it to you. "And being in agony, he was praying very fervently." All this was going on. "And during this, his sweat became like drops of blood falling to the ground." Now, the medical community would call this hematidriosis. That is, the capillaries underneath the surface of the skin would burst and the clotting blood would mix with the sweat of the person under great duress, and so that they would sweat a mixture of water and blood. You think about that. Jesus shed a little blood in the garden too. Now what did he pray? He, the model for us. Well, the gospel accounts record basically the same prayer. Matthew chapter 26 gives us a few things. I want to give you two or three things here about this prayer. First, I want you to notice Christ's opening statement. Look at verse 39 and get ready to underline a very key phrase that will be repeated twice. "He went a little beyond them. He fell on his face and prayed, saying," here's that phrase, "My Father," two words, "My Father, Abba Father," your translation might read, "if it is possible, let this cup pass from me, yet not as I will, but as thou will." Skip to verse 42. "He went away again a second time and prayed, saying, Abba, Father," there it is, "My Father, if this cannot pass away unless I drink it, thy will be done." Now in the Aramaic, "My Father," literally "Abba, Father," is a term of dependence. It is a term of possessive endearment. Some have tried to take that Aramaic expression, Abba, and translate it, Daddy. And I think it falls far short. Daddy is an American expression. It's a Western idea. I noticed when my wife and I traveled to France, the little kids called their daddies Papa. A similar expression. It's not necessarily an intimate term. In fact, my kids call me Daddy when they want stuff. And they will outgrow it. They will grow up and be embarrassed that they ever called me Daddy. Because now it's Dad. See? So to refer to God the Father as Daddy doesn't necessarily refer to intimacy. In fact, it may trivialize him. The Aramaic expression is precious simply because it is possessive. Literally translated, it means my Father. Mine. He's mine. He's my Father. It is so potent for us to learn that, because here in this garden, you would think that in this great distress, it would drive Christ to do what we would be tempted to do, and that would be to say, "Oh, are you really mine? Where are you? Are you really my Father?" See, we come to the false conclusion that pain means the absence of God, that if he really were mine, this wouldn't happen. Oh, no. Jesus models it well, and he says, with the same kind of Christ-like maturity that we are to have when we go through our garden, we pray, "My Father," that is, "I know you're mine, and I trust you as mine, and I know you haven't left me alone." Now, I want you to notice as well Christ's honest struggle. Look at verse 39. My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Shocking words. Verse 42. Look at that again. My Father, if this cannot pass away, unless I drink it, thy will be done. Now you remember the cup is a categorical term for all of the suffering of Jesus Christ. His betrayal, his crucifixion, his death, his abandonment, that is, God the Father will simply turn his back on God the Son. That doesn't mean that the triunity of God is severed and now it's a duality. It simply means that the Father ceases to be intimate with the Son. The Son ceases to have fellowship with the Father for those hours. And that is the cup here. Fellowship will be lost while God the Son becomes filthy sin. Do you know what it means when it says that he became sin for us who knew no sin? I don't. We can try to understand with our puny little minds, but we can hardly come close. A writer by the name of Mark Mosley astonished me by gathering by words a little droplet from this ocean of truth, this thought of Christ becoming our sin. I want to read this to you. Listen to this. It's a long paragraph, but I think it will startle you too. Jesus will bear the sins of the Assyrians who gloated over their captives they skinned alive. Jesus will bear the sins of SS troops machine gunning women and children who ran from burning synagogues with clothing ablaze. Jesus will bear the sins of child molesters making sure their victims never testify, of pharaohs sacrificing thousands of laborers' lives to build themselves a deifying tomb. Jesus took on all this and more. He was tossed about in the endless storm of enraged fathers beating toddlers to death, pimps seducing runaways into lives of drugs and prostitution, Canaanites burning their children to Moloch, nice church ladies cannibalizing other nice church ladies over coffee, impoverished parents in China selling their daughters into slavery. He will bear the sins of Bible-believing leaders praying long and loud while their wives sit in the back pews hoping heavy makeup covers their bruises. Jesus will tumble alone. He will bear the sins of embezzlers, gangsters, bullies, rapists, liars, the indifferent, the sadistic, the self-righteousness. It's a scene of unbearable horror and unspeakable madness. He is the accused for us all, bearing the weight of abused children, families destroyed by adultery or apathy, civilizations decaying, wars ravaging, victims, yet through it all, deep in the terror of hell, he keeps his eyes wide open. He is not just a bystander caught in the accident. He has come deliberately. He will accept it all, absorbing the full force of this storm of wrath in his body and mind and heart and soul until there is nothing left to feel. Finally, the tumbling will slow a bit. The storm will slacken, and Jesus will lift himself on his nailed feet to snatch a gasp of air and force his swollen tongue to shout, "It is finished! I've come! I've seen! I've paid for! I've felt!" Is it any wonder that Christ would stagger about in the garden, looking full in the face of this horrible grave, and say, "Oh, my Father, if there is any other way." But then I want you to notice his total submission. The last part of verse 42, he had already mentioned it earlier. Every prayer ended this way. He said, "But thy will be done." You know, when you and I pray in our garden, when we are surrounded by sorrow, we tend to try to conform his will to ours, praying, "Father, please let my will be done." But Jesus, the model man, surrenders his agonized, distressed will to the will of God. Now, based upon what Jesus Christ has just shown us, what are we to learn? Let me give you a couple of thoughts. Three words, primarily, as you walk through your personal Gethsemane. Word number one is realize. realize what? That Gethsemane's are the inevitable experience of all who follow Jesus Christ. You want to walk after the Lamb? You will walk through Gethsemane. Paul wrote that I might know him and the power of his resurrection. And we put a period right there, and he keeps on going. And the fellowship of his suffering. Hebrews already said it, and we read it, that he, the Son, being a man, though God, would learn obedience through the things that he suffered. See, that is the purpose of what you go through. That garden you may be in, or have been in, or will be in, is for learning obedience, so that the Father will chisel you into the image of that Lamb. You know how tragic it is for you and I to go through times of suffering and not learn obedience? You know what that means? That it's wasted. We have sorrowed for nothing. We have experienced pain with no spiritual productivity. What a waste that would be, would it not? Remember would be the second word. Remember that intimacy with God does not erase the potential for pain. Fellowship with God does not help us avoid the gardens. It helps us walk through the gardens like the Lamb did. I think of the story of Ron Hamilton. Maybe you know him. You've bought some of the cassettes for your children, maybe of his music. He lost an eye to cancer. He went into that operation not knowing if he'd come out with two or one eyes. When he came out, the doctor came up and was there talking with him, and he told him that he would be wearing a patch because he did lose one of his eyes. That would become a launching pad for his ministry, and he is known by literally thousands of children as Patch the Pirate, and he writes music for them. Let me read you his testimony put to music. Listen to this song, just a phrase or two. Now I can see, he says. Testing comes from above. God strengthens his children and purges in love. My Father knows best, and I trust in his care. Through purging, more fruit I will bear. Oh, rejoice in the Lord. He makes no mistake. He knoweth the end of each path that I take. For when I am tried and purified, I shall come forth as gold. Realize. Remember. Third, recognize. Recognize that when you're in the garden, close friends can be reassuring, but they cannot be replacements for the Father. Let's take another look at Christ's associates here as we wrap this up. His closest friends on earth, here they are, verse 40. And he came to the disciples, the three he'd brought in with him, and asked them to watch and pray. And he found them sleeping and said to Peter, so you men could not keep watch with me for 1 hour. Ouch, that hurt. Verse 41, keep watching and praying that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Skip to verse 43. And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. And he left them again and went away and prayed a third time, saying the same thing once more. Then he came to his disciples and said to them, are you still sleeping, taking your rest? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hand of sinners. Arise, wake up, Peter, James, John. Let us be going. Behold, the one who betrays me is at hand. Now, as I read this passage in Matthew over and over again, different facets of Gethsemane stood out to me, but it wasn't until later on that this struck me here. Jesus specifically asked his closest three friends to pray with him. Certainly, for him. Two times he said, men, will you pray too? And Peter and James and John slept. Will you watch with me? Will you share my burden? And his three closest friends on earth dozed off. But what a wonderful lesson here. You know, one of the ways you'll know you're experiencing a Gethsemane is that nobody will be able to go through it with you. Your wife, husband, closest friends, son, daughter, father, mother, none of them will be able to go through that. No one except this other one who went through it alone, this Lamb. And the message he can communicate to you and to I, to me, is this: I understand. I've walked through Gethsemane. I know what it's like to be surrounded by sorrow. And I can tell you the Father understands as well. So in the garden, Jesus looks into this grave, and he, being God, can drink in all of the horror of that moment, knowing what he will face. And yet from this moment forward, he will walk toward the cross without ever a moment of hesitation, without any more recoil, without any more prayers, "Father, could there be another way?" And that garden stands as a testimonial to his willingness to die. And as he walks from this garden all the way to the cross, he, the Lamb, shows you and me how to walk through our garden too. Let's pray. O Lamb of God, we again marvel, and yet we can only begin to scratch beneath the surface of deep truth. And we still really don't understand, but maybe we observe just a little clearer what that garden was like. Father, I don't know every heart here, but I know that there are people here who have been, or who are, or who will have to walk through a garden like Gethsemane. I pray that our response would be to cry, "Abba, Father, my Father," and that our lives would be a living tribute to the example of the Lamb of God, whom we worship for his suffering, his dying for us.